Agriculture, Environment, Natural Resources, Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome, members. We have a quorum. And first order of business today will be House File 2886. Representative Horsch? Hosh? Representative Hosh? Not here. Representative Hollis, is he in the room? Not here. Representative Poppy?
Representative Poppy?
Yay!
Oh, Poppy.
Representative Poppy. House File 3407. Representative Wagenius will move House File 3407.
I will.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Terry.
Thank you for being here.
Yes. We believe kind of in the first come, first serve, so I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jean Poppy, the state representative from District 27B, which includes most of Maurer County. And this bill is a request for an increase in funding for Maurer County to use for loans for septic systems. We all have heard about the problems that some people have with regard to straight pipe sewer septic systems, and as well as just failing systems and the need for cleaning up our water. And we have some specific needs in Maurer County that we'd like to be able to figure out a way to address. And with me today, I have two people. I have Daryl Franklin, who is with the Department of Environment in our county, and Craig Oskarson, who is the county administrator. And so I would ask that Mr. Franklin would just address the committee.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as director.
Yes, I'm Daryl Franklin, Maurer County Environmental Services Director. Thank you, Representative Osment, for the opportunity to be here, and Representative Poppy in inviting us.
Yes, I'm Craig Oskarson. I'm the county coordinator for Maurer County.
What I have before you is kind of a summary of the IST loan program that the county has been involved in. And I'll just very quickly highlight the program. The county got involved originally in 95-96 when the Department of Trade and Economic Development had loan funds available. The county applied for and received $400,000 of ISTS loans. The money was loaned out. It was simply a one-time opportunity. Once the money was loaned out and repaid, we had a repayment schedule with the state of Minnesota. Later, the county applied to the Department of Agriculture for best management practices loan funds, starting out with our first $50,000. Since that time, we've been successful in receiving additional funds from the Department of Ag. We now have approximately $350,000 of money from the Department of Ag for loans, showing that the county was not simply dependent on state funds. The county board has put in, and Craig is saying it's somewhere between $200,000 to $300,000 of their own money to be loaned on sewer systems. And again, we kind of talk about the number of sewer systems loaned. Today, we are seeking specific requests and help for three major areas. And as Gene said, relating to the clean water legacy, it's important, and clean straight pipes. One is the area of Teope. It's a very small, incorporated area. It's under orders, I think is the proper term, by the PCA, because they have small lots. There's no municipal sewer system. There's just kind of a pipe. Some people have septics, others don't. We've worked with them. We've worked with the Southeast Minnesota Water Resources Board on Teope, and it looks like the best way to address this is individual sewer systems, but we need additional funds to do that. The second area is Nickelville, and again, it's a small area. It is not an incorporated city, but it's a cluster of maybe 15 to 20 homes on small lots. Again, they had a system that was called like an Imhoff tank, but that's been years ago, and it's failing and then dumping into the waters of Dobbins Creek. There are other areas in the county. One is called the Woodhaven area. Again, all of these were built prior to regulations. Their lots are small. The systems have been failing, and they need help with that. So therefore, the county is requesting the funds, you know, to augment our current program. I'd be happy to answer any question that the representatives have about our program.
Okay, the one question I have is when the Department of or Minnesota Department of Trade and Economic Development in 1996 provided a loan, and then you had to pay that loan back to them also?
That is correct, sir. The way they explained it, Mr. Chair, is that it was some residual funds. They had it, and we were able to use it over this 10-year period and pay it back. We actually, 10 or 12 years ago, sent letters through our representatives and senators saying, gee whiz, why don't you let us keep this money and revolve it? And the response back, it was some extra federal money. I don't quite understand the intricacies of it, but we had to pay it back.
That's too bad.
We agree with you, sir.
Well, I suspect that money evaporated doing something else, and it could have been an ongoing effort that would have taken care of
it. It would have been very helpful, sir, to have that money to be recycled.
Okay. Mr. Magnus.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should... Doesn't DEED still have this program, the waste... We just had Mr. Coleman come in and testify on that the other day, and I think that's... The testimony we heard the other day, everything was kind of in flux, as I understood it, and he was going to come back and reply back to us at a later time. Maybe we could have him come back and talk about this specific case, too, because as my understanding, those funds are grant money, outright grant monies.
We can also find out how this dovetails with the Clean Water Legacy Program, which should be providing some grants as well as loans for
grants and all that. Right. So.
Hey, other testimony, other questions? Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Representative Poppy, you had another bill for a specific area, and this is outside that area now, right?
Thank you, Representative. Actually, Nickelville is still we're still working on trying to make sure that we get Nickelville taken care of. And so last year what we came forward and we asked for an increase in the length of time that the money could be granted for and the increase in the amount. They still are working on trying to get the land because the people that live in that little area, it's like 16 homeowners and they have such small land themselves, they have to purchase the mound system in another area, so you're going to have to purchase the land. So this would allow the county actually to have the funds to be able to take care of them along with two other small areas, because most of the money isn't an ag best practices money, so it goes toward feedlots and other things. So the money isn't necessarily just for these larger septic systems. And so the money does revolve out of the county, but they need more money to be able to take care of the ones that have the septic needs. Thank you for the question.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, any further testimony?
Do you want to think that? No, I think we are through. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, House File 3407 be laid over possible inclusion in the supplemental bill.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for this opportunity.
You're welcome. Let's see. We have Representative Howes.
Howes or Hodge?
I saw him in the audience. Over here. Welcome to the committee. House File 3494. I'll move that House File.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is requesting $50,000 in funding for the University of Minnesota Department of Forest Resources to do more interviews, surveys, and studies dealing with the sustainable forest. The sustainable, I'm going to get this wrong now. Representative Bill, will you help me? Sustainable Forest Initiative that we created, I believe it was 6 years ago. And we had a bill in policy yesterday that we brought forward that makes some small changes to the way it's structured. And the program has been working rather well, except it hasn't been used, I think, as much as as we thought it would. We changed some of the payment structure in a bill yesterday so that in order to keep this property in the program, if someone were to sell it and it was a new owner, we redefined the claimant on the money that was received, so the money would follow the claimant or the owner or new owner rather than follow the property. There was a legal case a few years ago that Representative Dill is real familiar with, and I'm not, but that was solved outside of court. But the forestry folks and revenue thought that this might pertain to this, that what we have here, so they've made some changes to better clarify where the money follows. In other words, it follows the owner of the property rather than the property, and that's to keep the property in the incentive program.
Okay. Are there questions? Representative Wiginius.
You suggested that perhaps there wasn't the participation that had been expected. Do people speculate why?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginius, I think there's been a fear that if they it's an eight-year program. After 4 years, you can appeal to have the land removed from the program, but you still have to wait 4 years. And I think there's just nervousness on people's parts that this program would succeed, and the fact that there was a court case when the land was transferred, a fear that if you sold it to someone else, that new owner would not be able to get the payments or use the program. So I think it's more that people just have been a little nervous that it would be here and it would be around. And I think it's one of the best ways we have of protecting our forestry industry and our forestry.
Okay, the Representative Howes, can you shed a little light as to why it came to us when it's actually a study at the University of Minnesota? It should have gone to higher education, or what was your understanding on that?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that question. I really don't know why it came here. I think maybe because the other bill went to environment policy and then out, and this is sort of, it's not a companion, but it's on the same issue. And I believe we did, when we did the Sustainable Forestry Act, I believe it went through Chairman Heckmark's committee and your committee.
Jeff Pauls, what I'd suggest is that we can always keep this on our radar screen. That's not a problem. I suggest that we send this file over to the higher education finance for them to also take a look at.
Sure.
And, as you know, there's quite a bit of discussion with regard to different types of finances that are ongoing right now at the university, and never know when something may all of a sudden fall in place. Get it in the right form. So are there any questions for members? President Dale.
I wanted to give just a little more light on the Representative Wiginius's question. Part of what I sense is happening from people out in the field is the big landowners have participated in this. You know, people with thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres. But the smaller landowners that have 300, 160 acres, 80 acres haven't participated because of didn't seem that attractive to them. Plus, it took away some of their option to actually sell a piece while it was in the program, and then have it sell it to some, for example, hunters that want to build a cabin, those types of things. So, I think what part of the idea, at least what I've heard rumbling around, is how can they make this program more attractive to not prohibit, but to prevent kind of upstage or circumvent the fragmentation of the smaller parcels. You know, we've been concentrating on these bigger parcels, and now they're trying to work their way down into the smaller areas as well. Because, you know, I mean, a quarter section makes four nice parcels for somebody that has surrounded by county, state, federal, and tribal land. You know, that's part of what this is about.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, I'd move that House File Number 3394 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Higher Education Finance Committee. Any questions on that motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion fails. It's passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hoff. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And all you should do now today is have a hearing from Representative Haas, and you'll get all the Larrys today. thank you for granting a hearing on this bill today. I apologize for being late, as this was not on my schedule, so I'm going to have to find out why that is. But what this bill is asking is for a $6,000 grant to the city of Avon for doing studies of xylene. And if I could, I'd like to see if we could have a verbal amendment onto this bill, which came out of discussions from the Senate hearing, after 1.8 after xylene.
Let me put the bill before.
Okay.
Representative Wagenius moves House File 2886.
Okay.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to put it in the order that I would like, on line 1.8 after xylene, if you can put "and other VOCs."
And other VOC?
Correct.
Okay, that's volatile organic compound?
Yes. You have your acronyms right.
And we probably should spell that out so that we.
Okay.
So we'll actually put those words in there. Everyone understand the amendment? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion fails. Bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, this bill came out of an issue from one of my small cities of Avon. We have a pre-finishing plant that does wood products, trim, doors, and of the sort. Currently, they're looking at expanding their permit from the PCA to 90,000 tons of VOC emissions. There's a concern in the community of what this means. Avon is kind of in a ravine surrounded by hills in the area and has experienced high levels of an odor from these xylene emissions. And right now, just the odors are a concern, but we really do not have an idea of what the emissions are in the city, where the concentrations are of xylene and other volatile organic compounds. And currently, the business has volunteered to do an EAW worksheet. But at this time, before an expansion of that permit is done, the community is looking at where exactly are the emissions in Avon. This is a bill that is supported both by the citizens of Avon and the business that is looking for the expansion of their permit. I'm happy to say that through the discussions and through working between the different entities and interest groups, that they have a working relationship to try to deal with these issues. The odor is so strong in Avon, in fact, that the business is actually starting to insert butterscotch scent into their finishing components, just so there's a better smell in the community. But one of my concerns is that some potential linking that we do have increased cases of asthma at the elementary school. And one of the things that I would like to see the study do is really get a scientific definition of where we're at in the city of Avon. I'm fearful that people are going to link certain health hazards or health effects in that community to this one business or plant. And before we do that, we need to have some more information. And the community needs to be aware of what their exposure is to. And the reason we came up with the $6,000 number is because the particular business has paid several fines for exceeding their permit that they currently have. So we're just trying to redirect some of that fine money that they paid into a study that could benefit the community. And I could ramble on, but I'd rather answer questions if there are any.
And can you give us just a little history as to the MPCA's involvement in this? Why haven't they performed the study, made the determination?
The involvement of the PCA was, I mean, first when the application for an increased permit was done. They were moving forward in that process, and then the community had many petitions signed requesting for an EAW to be done before that permit was granted. During that time, through discussions, the business has voluntarily committed to doing an environmental assessment worksheet. And one of the components that we would like to see within that is a study, but it's not a requirement for the permitting process under the PCA guidelines. So we're trying, that's why we're trying to get this in there. The PCA isn't opposed for doing the study, but there is a fiscal cost to that. So we're trying to find a way in which the city and the residents and possibly the state can work together into having a study in which we actually have scientific data in which we can base our decisions on. Right now, a lot of it's based on emotion, speculation, and that's the wrong way to go, especially for a small community that wants to encourage business development and expansion of their businesses. Over 20 employees work at this place, and we don't want to impact those local residents who work in the city of Avon. So this is kind of a compromise to finding out what really is the case.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Hosh brings up an interesting point that I've been thinking about for more than just this bill in various departments, and I guess I'd ask Mr. Reinholtz to help us out here. He talked about the company over the last, I don't know how long, has paid several fines into the PCA for various issues. Mr. Reinholtz, is that going to the state general fund, or is that going to a dedicated fund within the department that's used by them for their internal activities?
Mr. Rino?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie,
if you don't know, Mr. Rino, I want to put you on the spot.
I probably should look that up before I answer, but I believe that it does go into a special revenue account and is statutorily appropriated back to them, but I will have to check.
Again, Mr. Chair, I think that, it's one thing to pay fines, but I've seen, and I think there's others in this committee and in the legislature that have noticed a real preponderance of not only fines, but increases in the dollar amounts that are being charged. And I see it in my own profession. Over in commerce, I've had several complaints, for example, from appraisers who, because they miss their licensing deadline by a couple days, they're fined $500. Or I had a nurse call me. She didn't renew her nurse license in time. $1,000 because they're a couple days late. And I suspect, Mr. Chair, that a lot of it is budget crunch, and I'm not blaming them for that, but I think it'd be interesting to know what the fines they paid, and couldn't we put that to some good use for the community of Avon by cycling that money back out and into something like this, or think through how we might approach that in the future, because I'd really like to see that money do some good when it comes in for fines.
If we could have MPCA give some testimony on this particular situation and maybe answer some of the questions that you've raised. Is there anyone here from MPCA?
Mr. Chair, members, Mike Sandusky. I'm the Director of the Environmental Outcomes and Analysis Division at the Pollution Control Agency. Let me provide a little bit of background. First of all, correct, this particular company has voluntarily gone forward with an environmental assessment worksheet, but what has not been said yet is that already, pursuant to that process, they are beginning an air emissions risk analysis, which is another pursuant to the EAW process, is voluntary. That air emissions risk analysis will examine all of the relevant air toxics emissions from that facility. And over the course of the last several years, what that process has deemed to do in situations like this is identify all the principal risk drivers, which compounds are actually the ones that we need to pay attention to. And then pursuant to the authorities that the agency has, we frequently, through the course of this air emissions risk analysis, either require changes to process that reduce those risks to an acceptable level pursuant to health department standards, or require additional control equipment. So I think one of the relevant questions for this committee, and those costs, by the way, the cost of doing the air emissions risk analysis and then any subsequent changes that are required pursuant to the expansion in this case, are borne by the company. And so what's difficult, the question I have in my own mind, and I talked to my the PCA's air monitoring supervisor, who's the most knowledgeable person in the state, about what can be had for $6,000, and his opinion was very doubtful that something substantive relative to air emissions from this facility can be had for $6,000 and would be would not really augment the information that we're going to receive pursuant to the air emissions risk analysis.
Could you answer a question? What happens with the fines when you...
Mr. Chair, you know, there was a time when I could do that, and but I'm not in that world anymore, so I would not want to go out on the long plank on this one.
Okay, we'll find out as to how that process works. Representative Gania.
Yes, along those same lines, when I heard that statement of fines, I had very similar but slightly different question. You all have the opportunity to issue administrative penalty orders. And instead of fining, you had issued an order that said, you've gone over the limit, but we'll set this, and we'll fine you, but we'll set this money aside, and it can be used to fix the problem or do a study. Am I correct in my understanding of your authority under an administrative penalty order?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vilginius, you know, once again, I'm not familiar with this situation, and I've been out of the regulatory enforcement scene for 10, 12 years now. So I don't know what practice is right now, and I'm just not that familiar with it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that is the law, and maybe we need to check it out, because always the best thing to do would be, you know, if there is a problem, and you say, there's a problem, we're going to fine you, but we can use that money to study it or fix the situation. That was the joy of administrative penalty orders, and I don't know that there's been any change in the law in the last years. And that would, it just seems to me, following along with Representative Junkie, that would have been an effective way to deal with this situation. So let me just, if I could follow up with one question. When do you expect the study to be done that is being done now on a voluntary basis? And will we, as the public, be able, and the public and Avon, be able to see the study?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vilginius, these typically take from 3 to 6 months. I haven't asked. I know it's early in this process, so I'm not even sure the time schedule has actually been produced, and it's typical that a time schedule will be produced. And, yes, it's a very, it's part of the entire EAW process, so it's heavy on public participation.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Helen may have an answer. Mr. Helen?
Mr. Chairman and members, the enforcement funding penalties paid are deposited in the state treasury and credited to the environmental fund, so they are available to be used for PCA purposes.
The expenditures on the environmental fund are appropriations that we make?
Right.
So it all comes back to us, and then we reappropriate those out. It's not automatically going to the MPCA.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One other question to Representative Hoshman, I would, and to the department, if you could both review this and come let us know, not here, but in the next few days, how much money they have paid in fines, say in the last year or two or three. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it 6,000? Is it more? Is it less?
And I know there's also programs that they have. Mr. Sandusky, what is this, the SEP program? Do you recall what that is?
Supplemental Environmental Projects, Mr. Chair, and it's actually the popularity of directing penalty dollars to projects that have some, obviously, number one, environmental benefit, and two, which is very important, some nexus to the actual violation or industry that's being penalized. And I think, I believe, Mr. Chair, we keep a running account of, an annual account of how much money is directed to supplemental environmental projects.
And that's another program they have to try and, when they have a violation, that they can actually direct those dollars to take care of a problem, even if it's not right on that same site, but it's somewhat related in some fashion. And so that I know that they use that quite a bit. So, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Junkie, I can definitely find out the fine amount. I'm sorry that I don't have all the information in front of me, nor the testifiers I'd like to have here today, but we came up with the $6,000 number linking to the fines that happened. Paid in the past. Just a couple comments I'd like to respond to also on the air emissions assessment. That's something that we're very happy that the business is doing. But that calculates emissions just kind of through a use factor in which, you know, if you use a 55-gallon drum of a certain material, you can kind of assess how much VOCs are leaving the smokestacks. The problem with Avon is with this geographical location is that oftentimes with the hills surrounding it, that the air is just stagnant and that it stays still. And the concern is what is the real levels of VOCs or xylene in the communities? And we want to get that answer. We don't want to make assumptions that it's higher or that it's a health risk before we move forward because we don't want to be a negative impact to the business. But the community is definitely interested in knowing where those levels are at. And also for the study cost, we believe that we can have a good partnership. We have a wonderful educational institution of St. John's and St. Ben's nearby who have been involved in this process. And we think that we can have some professors and professionals doing the study, which is in the community of Avon, which is just 3 miles away. So we're trying to build partnerships and have collaborative efforts between all interests of business, of environmental concerns, of the community in general. And we would just greatly appreciate that any help that we can have with this as, you know, we do want to move forward on this in a responsible manner, and the study is a vital component in that.
And Mr. Sandusky, I think that your testimony was that you believe that that information will be forthcoming in some of the evaluations that they have to take place in order to get their permits for expansion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, a couple of additional items. I don't know how far we want to go down this path, but the air risk analysis actually does use modeling, including variables related to meteorology. What I want to make absolutely clear, and it is proven to be very effective and accurate relative to individual facility risk assessments. If, in fact, the question before the citizenry of Avon and other concerned stakeholders is the general air quality above and beyond what's related to the emissions from this particular facility, that will not be addressed in the air emissions risk analysis.
And is that your concern, the mix of what this facility's its impact as well as the aggregate impact of all other emissions in the community?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The primary concern is related primarily to this business. With their request for increased emissions permit, they're asking for a doubling of their emissions. And the concern is, you know, is this something that we really need to be concerned about, or is the smell just a smell? Or is the smell actually indicative of higher levels of xylene or other VOCs? And it's, you know, some people say, absolutely, you know, we do have health risks. And other people say, yeah, and it's just a smell. We don't need to be worried about it. And we really can't move forward in a constructive manner until we know, have some you know, hard data that we can relate to and that we can give to the public. So it's primarily linked to this individual business, as there's not, you know, this isn't a large community with several industrial sites that are giving out various emissions. It's mainly this one business.
How large is Avon?
Excuse me?
How large is Avon?
Mr. Chair, the community of Avon is about 1,500 people, I believe.
Do they have full-time staff?
Yes, they do, Mr. Chair.
I'm wondering if the MPCA could, and maybe you have attempted in the past to get them fully informed as to what you're going to be involved with, but if they could get better acquainted with your process that you have ongoing with this particular company. Because it seems to me like to jump in with another study when we haven't collected the information that we need for the permitting process may be a little bit premature, especially if you want to try and get the full impact of the whole thing. But if they can make sure that the questions that people in Avon have, see if they're already on the list of what the MPCA is going to evaluate and really get that clarified, I think that may be helpful. Because I agree that $6,000 is not a very complex study, you know, on an issue and when you're dealing with this type of a situation. But the information may be there. It's just a matter of getting it interpreted to where that data is useful to the city to answer their questions and not just the MPCA's questions.
Mr. Chair. Yes. Mr. Chair, and I'd like to clarify that we're not looking for, you know, all this money to be the only sole source of funding for the study. You know, it's kind of like a bonding project. So there should be a local commitment. And there's also private commitments and individual fundraising that people are looking at also doing. So this wouldn't be the only component of funding that study.
President Hosh, I know I'm sure you realize that we don't have any dollars this session. So what I'm trying to do is to get your answers through the existing process as much as we can. And sometimes we can just, if there's a couple of questions that you're trying to get evaluations on, and they may be able to expand their data to cover those questions, we can get that agreement ahead of time, get what you want without having to come up with another appropriation to do it. We're trying to see how we can dovetail that. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for starting down that direction, because I think that my question to Mr. Sandusky follows right along with what the chair was saying. What I hear for the need in the community, and I know xylene is very toxic, and I suspect that the moms and the dads are most worried about the children in school, I mean, because the impact would be the most on the children. So in your studies, will you be, I mean, I would look, for example, at the elementary school, because I suspect there is one in town.
Perhaps.
Will you be going into the elementary school and monitoring the air within that school?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, an air emissions risk analysis will identify and model impacts on all appropriate public facilities, always schools. In situ monitoring is not part of the air emissions risk analysis. Modeling has demonstrated to be very accurate related to short distance impacts. And I've just heard it's about a half a mile, and that's well within a radius where everyone can be very comfortable with the resulting description of the impact.
I'm sitting here thinking as a parent, and as a parent, I can hear you telling me, okay, as a scientist, I might hear you telling me that modeling is wonderful and it works. As a parent, I think I would remain skeptical, and I would be worried about my children. I mean, that's just the way moms and dads are. And so, if this is going to be an ongoing controversy, and the plant does want to expand, and the community does want to expand the plan, it seems to me that maybe taking one additional step would solve the problem one way or the other. and give a comfort to a community that seems stressed to me. And I can't imagine that that additional expense would be so bad that the company who wants to expand could not bear that expense. I mean, I'm only talking about one elementary school, because my guess is that that is where the biggest concern will be.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bouguinas, I think you hit the nail right on the head. We have an elementary school about a half mile away. Where this actually really came up is we have a post office right across the street in which the air intake is right next to the smokestack, or to the emission stacks. And, you know, I appreciate the modeling, but that skepticism is still there. It's a model. I mean, is it hard data? And there are, there is hard data that asthma cases are above the average in Avon. And I'm skeptical to even bring that up, because I don't want to link it to this business, because we don't know that. But it is there. And, you know, people are going to draw inferences and make a correlation with that. And it's a frustrating process for the business and for the community when that's happening and we don't have any substantial evidence to point to. We're just inferring on that. So you hit it right on the head. We need the hard data.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hosh, I've been through Avon numerous times. Just what is the population of Avon?
I said I believe it's 1,500, but it could be up to 2,500. It's growing. It's a fast-growing community, but it is one of my smaller communities.
Yes, I was hoping for a response from Mr. Sandusky to the suggestion that we might take this additional step to relieve the stress in this community, because it could be ongoing forever, and it's not going to help you to give a permit based on modeling and then people still be suspicious of the government. If we take an additional step, maybe we can resolve that and everybody move forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bouguinas, I will direct the staff to require that in-situ ambient monitoring is conducted in the school.
Thank you, Mr. Sandusky.
Super. All right. Got a little something coming. Anything else, Representative Hosh?
I would just like to make one last comment, Mr. Chair. I greatly appreciate the committee's time, as I know everybody's been extremely busy. And I'd also like to thank the PCA on this. This has been a good process. It started out with a lot of concern and speculation, I think mistrust between some community members in the business, but I've just been delighted to see the direction that it's taken, and the PCA has been a partner in that, providing information, answering questions, and I know that they're busy with their staff with many, many other things, so I'd like to thank all the partners in this. This isn't something that we want to, you know, go off to and do on our own. We want to do it in partnership. So I want to just make that clear, because this has been a pleasure of moving forward on this. So.
All right, other questions? Anyone else in the audience want to speak on this bill? Okay, we'll lay this House File 2886 over as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Davis. Representative Davis, we have two bills that are yours that we're going to hear. Which would you like to do first?
Whatever you'd like, Mr. Chairman. Fine. We've got witnesses for both here.
Okay. Well, why don't we just take them as listed. House File 2619.
House File 2619.
Yes. Yes. Move that House File 2619 be considered for possible inclusion in the supplemental bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2619, I'll just give it a basic overview for you, and then I've got several witnesses that would like to testify to the bill. I wish I could take credit for this idea myself, but when the gentleman who thought of it is sitting next to me, I probably can't get by with that. What this bill does is it puts a dollar surcharge on the deer hunting license so that that money would then go into a fund, and that money would be used to pay locker plants, meat processors that are either USDA or Department of Agriculture, State of Minnesota approved, and the hunters could donate their deer to a food shelf. It would go and it would be processed, and then the food would go to the food shelf, and the surcharge from the deer hunter's license would then go and pay the locker plant for the dressing out of the venison. That's very simply what it is. It's a $1 surcharge on a hunting license. To get the bill in the order that I would like to call up a gentleman from the DNR who has some language. In Representative Hackbart's committee, there was some concerns, I believe, by Chairman Hackbart on some of the language as far as where the money would or how it would be used. Do we have that amendment, or could you join me?
Okay, I've moved House File 2619, and Representative Hackbarth, are you moving this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendment.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth moves the amendment. Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, if we would have the DNR explain the amendment. They brought the amendment forward. We discussed this issue in our committee, and Mr. Bogus could explain why this amendment's here.
Bogus.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Ed Bogus with DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife. And Representative Packbar's committee expressed concern about some expanded purpose for the money that would be collected in the surcharge to include deer management, and asked that we look at that issue. The reason that we had included that language, suggested that language in Representative David's bill was that if this bill were to become law and this money were just to go for a charitable donation program to feed the needy, as good as that is, it's looked on by the Fish and Wildlife Service that oversees the use of hunting and angling license dollars. That could be viewed as a diversion of license dollars if it seemed to be going to a social program. There's very strict rules, and the state's passed laws saying that we'll abide by those rules to use license dollars from hunters and anglers only for fish and wildlife management programs. So we felt we needed a tie back somehow with this program to our management program. The way that the bill was amended in Representative Hackbarth's committee, it would have allowed the use of the funds for deer management, including deer processing. The amendment that's before your committee today would strike the purpose of deer management for the use of this money and make it clear it could only be used for processing deer, but it would add that it would be processing deer taken for deer population management purposes, so that we have that management tied back to the reason the deer are being taken that we're helping to pay for processing to donate to charitable organizations. So there's various places in the bill that are noted in the amendment where we would need to make those changes to accomplish that purpose, and we feel it's very important. I know that Iowa and Wisconsin have programs like this where they have included deer management as a purpose for doing these types of programs. So, Mr. Chair, that's what the amendment is intended to do, and I'd be happy to answer questions if there are any.
Any questions on the amendment? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, are the programs at Iowa and Wisconsin mandatory or voluntary?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, Iowa, my understanding, is mandatory, and Wisconsin is a little bit of a mixture, and they have a voluntary checkoff that raises very little money. Compared to the cost of their program, they get a very small donation rate from their voluntary checkoff for this purpose. The bulk of how they pay for their program, to my understanding, is they've had a fairly long-standing $2 surcharge on all their deer licenses, and they have about I don't know, 50% more deer hunters than we do. I think we have about 450,000 deer hunters in Minnesota, and they have about 650,000. And they have a $2 surcharge on every deer license that was primarily being used to pay for crop damage. And they expanded the purposes of that to include venison donations. So that's where the bulk of their funding for their program in Wisconsin comes from. And that $2 is a mandatory surcharge.
Thank you, sir.
That's Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, I really don't know what to do with this amendment, because if I vote for it, dressing up a bad bill, and yet I would like to vote for at least have some control. I plan to vote against the bill. I don't like the bill at all, and just gave an a great reason not to vote for the bill is because you're talking about depredation surcharge, and now we're talking about feed the hungry surcharge, and pretty soon we're going to have it dressed up like that bill that's making its way through now, and with written taxes the other night when everything but the kitchen sink was added onto it. And I think it's a bad precedent to start. We went through this years ago and had a big fight about it then, putting a dollar surcharge on. And to get the deer hunters pay in church, they pay to the United Way, they pay to a lot of funds, and there's no reason to get deer hunting license involved in a social issue. And, but I think I'll vote for the amendment and against the bill.
Okay. Other questions on the amendment? Okay, the amendment is before us. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cornish.
One other question is, the DNR, go away. Sometimes, I've had a problem, this is the third time this year already with the DNR, is that sometimes when you help with an amendment on a bill, it's supposed that you support the bill. I'd like to know the clear answer from the DNR. Are you for, against, or neutral on the bill even after amended?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, the DNR is neutral on the bill. We see this as kind of on the margins of our mission because it's primarily for a social purpose. However, we can make a management tie to it. We did do some deer hunter surveys a few years ago that indicated hunters said they would shoot more deer if they could donate them to a charitable organization. But at this time, we don't have a position on the bill.
Mr. Chair.
And
once again, if you could take my message to the commissioner, I like the old days of the DNR when you actually came up and had an opinion instead of this neutral baloney. I like the PCA, even though it was unpopular the other day when the woman from the PCA appeared. At least they had an opinion and gave us some direction. And you folks have got biologists, aquatic biologists, hunting people, I mean, experts at it. And sometimes we look to you for direction, and neutral really doesn't help us much. So,
thank you, Chairman, to that point. I believe the DNR, I'd like to clarify, I think they're enthusiastically neutral.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for the DNR, so address it now. I still have not that resolved in my mind. The dollar fee that was added some time ago for feeding the deer. And we know now that feeding the deer is not where we want to go, and I've been told, well, we're going to use 50 cents for chronic wasting disease. That's fine, but my deer hunters want it some transparency. So if you're not going to feed the deer, subtract the dollar, add 50 cents for your chronic wasting disease, which we support that studying, but this, all of a sudden, well, yeah, we'll take this and shove this way and this that way, do not approve. So if you want to take a dollar off or at 50 cents off and then go from there, that's a starting point. You don't have to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reference to Representative Cornish's questions and comments, I actually have an issue that I would appreciate if the DNR were more neutral on.
It's all in the eye of the beholder around. Representative Wagenius.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, you're so right. It's all in the eye of the beholder. I look at the testimony we've had on this issue And I don't see that this money is clearly for primarily for a social purpose. We've got to get thin out these deer herds. And for the goodwill, deer hunters should be grateful to have an opportunity to shoot some more deer, because public is getting a little uptight about too many deer and banged up cars and eating the bulbs in the yard. And so just for public relations purposes, it's probably not a bad idea to go forward with this.
Actually, Representative Haynes, that's not a bad idea. We should send this over and have it be a surcharge on the automobile insurance industry.
I suggested that in committee, Mr. Chair. I would go for that.
Yeah, I think that might be a potential. Okay. Representative
Dill. Well, I had talked to Mr. Kelleher on a fishing trip. We went on about putting a $10 surcharge on the licenses, and then for if you purchase a deer hunting license, whether you're hunting or not, and you hit a deer, that then the DNR will pay for your deductible on your collision insurance. Because, I mean, if they're going to raise all these damn deer, we ought to be able to, the public is... The public is hitting them. I mean, I think they're great, but I mean, a $10 surcharge, and then you'd be buying insurance. We could self-insure like our health insurance. We do. We'd probably get the insurance companies to give us an actuarial on that. So that'd be $11.
Well, I'm sure they would give us one.
Now you understand why they say we're all in danger in the legislature.
Thank you for that brief moment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have two folks that have come in to testify on behalf of the bill, and I want to be very clear to the committee that, of course, most bills, whether it be in chairing the Ag Committee or former chair of the Commerce Committee or whatever bills I've had, I've always tried to achieve peace in the valley. We're not there yet on this one, but that's the way it goes sometimes. You need to vote for this bill because you can never feel bad for doing the right thing. But with that being said, the Minnesota Whitetail Deer Association supports this bill, and we've got the folks have testified. I'll go through maybe some of the other. I think the bow hunters testified on behalf of it. The Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, I'll be very clear, has concerns with the bill. And so there's not every group is on board here, but we do have a very distinguished a number of good groups that are supporting this legislation. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to the president of the Minnesota Whitetail Deer Association, Mr. Jim Box, who was the one that came to me with this idea. And we took a look at the Iowa plan. At that time, we didn't take a look at the Wisconsin plan. We took a look at the Iowa plan, and we visited about this in my Preston office. And I thought... And when he asked if I'd be interested in taking a look at this, I said, I absolutely would. I think it's a great idea. So I'll turn it over to the president of the Bluffland Whitetail Deer Association. I think I said Minnesota. Bluffland Whitetail Deer Association, Mr. Jim Botts.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Jim Botts. I live in Fillmore County. I'm currently president of Bluffland Whitetail Association, which is a organization that's 5 years old in southeast Minnesota that provides a voice for landowners and deer hunters and outdoors people to work together with DNR, like Ed Bogness, and we've established a good relationship with them to deal with issues that are prevalent to our area. Mr. Davids said he gave me credit for coming up with this idea, which is not really true, because I spent some time with the Chief of Wildlife of Iowa DNR last summer, and he explained how successful their program was going there. Apologies seem to be popular at the Capitol right now, so I'd like to apologize to Mr. Davids, because when he had his committee here 10 days ago, I was not here to provide some of the necessary information. I had a conflict, and so I kind of left him hanging out there without all the background. This bill keeps being talked about being a social program, and it's not. And I am also not neutral on this program. I am very pro in support of this program. The DNR needs more help in managing the population deer herd in Minnesota. And as a landowner, farmer, hunter, resident of southeast Minnesota, I think I have a pretty good finger on the pulse of what's going on with our deer herd. This program allows people who are hunters, and it gets complicated. You're going through the whole procedure, but the DNR is putting out bonus tags to increase the harvest, but most people don't have an outlet for this venison, which this program would produce. If we can get our herd, a herd isn't overpopulated everywhere, but in many areas of Minnesota it is now overpopulated, and we need more help. We're lucky. We have a great whitetail herd in this state. That's fabulous, but we need to get on top of things of the management where we have overpopulation. This program, if it is successful, which I can't imagine it wouldn't be, by reducing our overpopulation in certain areas, it'd be very beneficial to the DNR in their management practices. It would be beneficial to landowners. It would enhance road safety. And it also would enter into the disease picture, which is very big in Minnesota right now. We now have the first TB in cattle and deer in Minnesota since the early 70s. And that, for the field of agriculture, that is a very big deal. We also, just a week ago, found the first chronic wasting deer in Minnesota, which is also a very big deal. These diseases are definitely related to overpopulation. They're spread by nose-to-nose contact, so they aren't going to solve the issue of TB and chronic wasting, but they play an important factor in the issue of it. Like I said before, the history of this program, it is not a social program. That just happens to be a benefit of it when you get all done. The Wisconsin and Iowa, I have a lot of data on their programs that if you have questions later, I can try to answer them for you. Wisconsin processed over 7,000 deer last year. Iowa processed 5,000. Iowa had 324,000 pounds of venison that they donated, that they were able to provide to their food shelves from venison, donated venison. I have a lot of details on the programs in Wisconsin, Iowa. If you are interested in them, ask me when I get done. I have quite a bit of the data. I want to give you a short mathematical summary of our great herd that we have in this state. We have 1.25 million deer and growing. We harvest approximately 225,000 deer a year, which is 20%. Our herd before season opens is basically about 35% males, 65% females. The females are the part of the population that causes population increases. For the last 12 years, our hunting statistics have showed that 56 to 58% of harvest are male deer. So we're harvesting a majority from the minority of the population. This is not calculus, it's pretty simple, straightforward facts. So we need to find a way to harvest more females to get our population under control in areas where it's a problem. Several years ago, the DNR came out with up to 5 bonus tags that are available to every hunter. I think it's like 3% of the hunters are using more than 2 tags. It's very low because they do not have an outlet to get rid of the extra venison. Now, there's been some testimony on some negative aspects of this bill that I'd like to touch lightly. I want to dwell mostly on the positive because this bill is 100% positive, but I will deal with some of the comments I've heard about the negative parts. One thing I heard was the DNR does not have the final plan done to implement this. I agree, they don't. We talked to them in December, explained what we're going to do. We went at a great meeting with most of the people in St. Paul. We studied at length. They do not have the final plan, as far as I know, how to implement. But being the state of Wisconsin and Iowa have been able to implement it, I feel confident that our Minnesota DNR is capable of doing the same job. So I don't think, it doesn't bother me worrying about whether they can actually put this program into effect or not. Another comment I heard was that every time you have a new bill, there's a risk of getting amendments tacked on to things that are unrelated. Well, I'm not a politician, I'm not a political animal, but I don't understand the system that cannot have new bills for fear that it may end up with the wrong result. That's up to you people. So I don't consider that a reason not to consider this. They talk about the added cost. We originally asked for $1, which is what Iowa does. Wisconsin asked for $2. If it would make this bill more appealing to this committee, I would suggest someone here make an amendment to go with 50 cents, because we'll gladly go that route. Or if you have to, go to 25 cents. But let's get this program up and running at some stage. Another comment I've heard is, why are we asking deer hunters to pay for this program? Because it's not a deer hunter problem, it's a landowner problem. If I had a half hour, I could explain to you exactly why it's not a landowner problem, but I'm prejudiced on the factor. I think I could make some good arguments that it's really not a landowner problem. We deal with the regulations the Minnesota DNR puts out. Why not make it voluntary? Well, to start out with, if you're going to implement this program, you need to have a budget, you need to have a plan. People don't buy their license until a week or two before. You would have no idea how much you're going to recruit or take in. Wisconsin has a $2 surcharge. They collect $1.4 million. They have a voluntary program for that. 700,000 hunters had an opportunity, and they collected 17,000, which is a pretty small amount. That's better than what we have now, but that's not what I'm looking for. I would gladly entertain questions, but I only have one closing comment. If I haven't said anything that makes sense to you so far, let me point one illustration to you. Suppose we have a single mom with a 14-year-old youngster who decides they want to hunt. They have trouble raising the money to buy the license, and now somebody wants to stick more money on there that they have to pay for. Well, let's assume they are able to raise. Oh, incidentally, in a survey taken by the DNR, 70% of Minnesota hunters don't know how much their license costs. So whether we add 50 cents for one time a year, I'm not sure if it's a big factor. But going back to my example, let's suppose this young lady with her youngster is able to scrape up the money to buy a license with the $50 surcharge, 50 cent surcharge. Suppose they're really lucky and they harvest a deer. So what is this young mother going to do now? If you take the deer to a processing plant, it'll cost $80 to $100 plus dollars. If she found the money to do that, she's going to bring it home with no freezer. I would say that's going to work. And a lot of people process their deer their own, but I doubt that this young mother would have the equipment and the expertise to do it. If we have this surcharge, this young mother and her youngster can take their deer to the locker, donate it, and 3 weeks later or several weeks later, they can go to their local soup shelf and they can get this venison back so many pounds a week all winter long. So basically, this program will help the ones that it'll penalize the most. I am a native Minnesotan, and I'm proud of that. And I'm a Minnesotan farmer, and I'm also proud of that. And I'm also a Minnesota outdoorsman and a hunter. And I would be proud to participate in a 50 cent surcharge to help the DNR manage our herd and to provide as a bonus the venison to a food shelf. And I would entertain questions, and thanks for attention. Before I quit, I'll introduce Betty Wilkins, who has been doing this program for several years, where she's raised the funds privately. I just remembered one thing I forgot. About 3 years ago, several agencies, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, DNR, Betty, the Safari Club, the Minnesota Bull Hunters, and other groups went through a long procedure. They got the venison program completely put together. They have brochures. They have it done with the State Department of Health. Everything is done except one thing. They have no funding. So Betty has been doing this by volunteering and by raising private donations. And she's done a fabulous program, but she's done hundreds of deer, not thousands. So if you we'd like to let Betty speak, and then you can ask us both questions. Thank you.
Well, the committee, please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Betty Wilkins, and I come from East Central Minnesota. Our mailing address is Mora. Our farm is 13 miles south of Mille Lacs Lake. I can understand the farming situation because I've been there too. I've been a deer hunter for over 40 years, and I've been part of the venison donation program for 4 years. And most of that has occurred through the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I am a member of that group and a member of probably the best chapter in the state. That's the Snake River chapter. Our chapter 4 years ago saw a need with the large deer population in our area and the many nuisance permits given out by the DNR for animals to be taken and then by landowners and for predation purposes because they were just nuisances. We saw the need to start a program by which we would subsidize, help, encourage, do anything we could so that these deer could go, get harvested, and go to a good purpose. And we started out with actually helping the DNR by they would call and say, well, we have a farmer that needs to take 6 deer. We've given them permits for 6 deer. Well, they could leave them lie, or they could you be able to pay for the processing and distribute it, the meat somehow. So then I was the coordinator of that program, and I did all the upfront work and got the food shelves involved. They were happy to receive the meat. I delivered the meat. And so that's how we started. That fall, then we opened the program to area hunters. And we helped subsidize. If they would pay so much, we would pay so much. But, of course, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, when they pay for programs like this, and we have 6 communities in the state that MDHA has programs in. Ours is 1, but only 6 across the whole state. When our hunters are paying for that, too. So no matter how you do it, the hunter pays the bill. They pay $32.50. They pay $25 in Detroit Lakes. They pay, you know, they might pay the whole bill. Big steer processed 340 deer last year for this program. The hunters paid the bill. They paid the cost. So what Jim says about can hunters afford it? No, they can't. Not every one of them. There are some hunters that can afford this. But there's a whole lot of hunters that want to be part of the program, and I've visited with those hunters by phone, by email. I'm the contact for hunters through a variety of sources. One is the MDHA, Hunters Against Hunger Program. I was the coordinator there for a year and a half. I'm the contact for the Minnesota DNR info line on venison donation, and I'm the contact in our statewide effort to get this program going with a coalition of people interested in the program, and that's called Venison Donation Minnesota. So through all these contacts, I have had numerous emails from people saying, I want to donate, how do I go about it? Well, we have all the information for them. And then, well, how much do I, next question, how much is it going to cost me? Well, there's this couple, that married couple at State College State, that going to school, and they say, we both deer hunt, we want to give our deer. They can't come up with $130 to $150 to donate the deer. The father with the 2 sons that goes up to north of Duluth and says, we each want to harvest the deer. Of course they do. They each want to harvest on their tag, but we only use 1 deer. Unless they can come up with the other $150, they can't shoot those other 2 deer because there's a law against wanton waste. And hunters are ethical. I'm ethical. Jim's ethical. All of you hunters are ethical. We're not going to shoot animals we don't have a good way to disperse the meat so somebody can use it. Somebody who needs it can use it. So there's 3 ways you can give venison. You can give to a charity. You can give to a food shelf, you can give to an individual. We spell this all out in our website that we support where we try to help hunters out and everyone else who wants to be part of the program. But there is a venison donation program in Minnesota. Somebody said, well, how are we going to do this? You already have a structure. 2 years ago, in spring of 2004, the DNR, the Department of Ag, and several hunting organizations got together. They developed policy. I was part of that I was part of that meeting. They developed policy. They developed brochures to be distributed, which if any of you would like this, this is a brochure that lists the cooperators. They developed policy, and we started a program. We have made contacts with food banks. We have made contacts with all sorts of people, processors. There's a place. MDA works with processors to get them enrolled in the program. The DNR has the policies, all their regional and their area wildlife offices. We've all communicated, and they know how the program operates. There are individual hunting organizations that have different programs. We all work together to, so that the hunter can find places. But really, there's only six communities in the state where there is subsidized venison donation. And who are they subsidized by? When somebody says the hunter shouldn't pay for this program, every penny on this program comes from hunters now and will in the future. So your choice is, do I pay, have the hunter pay the $75, or do I, each of you pay 50 cents? That's the choice, but the hunter's going to pay the bill. They already are. Figures from last year, we keep track of this, the Department of Agriculture keeps track of this, and last year, in 2004, 223 deer were processed by 18 certified processors. Last year, 589 were certified, were processed and distributed by 22 processors. If that was a 264% increase, if that increase would continue, there'd be 1,500 deer distributed this fall. Cost approximately $93,000. So you can see where we're going with this. The interest is there. We hope that the legislature will allow all hunters to be a part of this program. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Other questions, Representative Costa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Davids, for bringing the bill, and thanks for bringing the testifiers. I just want to test members that I personally know Jim Vaught. I worked with his brother, actually, for a number of years and got to know the family that way, and I've been down to his farm. And any of you hunters want to see interesting display, stop into Jim's farm someday and visit him and go down in his basement. And he's got a big, he's got aerial photos of the entire area where they hunt in southeast Minnesota, where they've hunted for years since he was a kid. And a large group of hunters in the area, now his association, and they mark where they harvest deer for years and years and years. You can see the charts and the graphs. It's truly amazing, and he knows what he speaks of. And as you can tell from the testimony, I don't sit on Representative Hackbar's policy committee, so I don't often get to hear all the issues and the facts and figures that he brought forward, and I appreciate that, Jim, because I think it was well stated and truly credible, and you know what you're talking about. Secondly, members and Representative Davids, I agree we need to find peace in the valley. And I know Kelleher, Mr. Kelleher is wanting to speak on behalf of the deer hunters here, too. But I hope we can find a creative way to do this. This is about deer management. It absolutely is. And if we can, you know, think outside the box, I agree we need to find a way to pay for it. You know, maybe it should be general fund money, but we don't have a general fund target for this year. I mean, I think it's that. It should come out of the DNR budget somewhere, but if we don't have the excess, we have to generate it somewhere. The other concern that I've heard expressed, which maybe we can do something with Representative Davids, if it is for deer management and if it is a fact that we're not selling enough bonus tags because of the fact that we have our freezers full of venison, we don't need a third or a fourth animal or have room for it, maybe we have a blink on, blink off, that the surcharge goes into effect whenever there are bonus tags available somewhere in the state, so that we truly can sell those bonus tags and manage the herd, and that helps efficiently take care of that extra venison. You know, someone said, well, what about a year, you know, when we get back, if we ever get back to normal and we have deer shortages and we're down to one tag and it's bucks only and, you know, we really don't need it then. Well, fine, maybe we can blink on, blink off, but we don't need deer management out in the field. But I think, Representative David, there's got to be a creative way to do this. I think you're on to something very good here. And again, Iowa, Wisconsin has found a way to do it. I suspect in this great state we could figure it out too.
Any other questions?
Representative, I hope I didn't sound too cross before. It's just that the surcharge thing on the back of the hunters, well, it's a great idea. I mean, but if you could fund it in a different way, and I guess so the only fact that I would directly contradict would be that this is a deer management tool. The DNR has been trying to figure a way to kill extra deer for years and years with extra permits, with extra hours, with extra weapons. You can't kill enough deer. And the problem isn't because they don't have a place to go. I mean, hunter after hunter I talked to in the fall, as a conservation officer, as a farmer, as a landowner, they always got leftover tags. And it isn't a problem of getting it processed or finding them due. It's just you can only kill so many deer. So I don't think it's a deer management tool that you say it is. But I think it's a great program, a good idea. I just think that it should be spread out over the population of the state of Minnesota and not the deer hunters on the surcharge. That's the problem I have with it. The food shelf idea or the extra meat for needy families is great, but just find some different fee system is the problem I have.
Any other questions? Okay, any other testifiers for the...
I do not believe so. The
have some
proponents.
Opposing, so.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. A couple comments. We had three resolutions at our corporate board meeting in March on this subject. Two were very identical to Representative David's bill about a dollar surcharge. Both those resolutions were voted down by our corporate board, which is about 70 statewide chapters. The third resolution, which did pass our corporate board, was to request an LCMR grant for $250,000 for this purpose. In regards to Representative Wilgenius's comments about deer population, deer management, and those sorts of things, we have supported since, I guess, 1995 or 6, just about every liberalization of deer tags, deer licenses, deer hunting opportunities, and those sorts of things. There was some comments made about Representative Dill about having a surcharge on insurance companies or some other way to deal with the funding. Representative David's second bill this morning is for the second harvest food shelf for milk, and that request is for a general fund appropriation. So I'm limited in what I can support in regards to surcharges on the deer licenses. I don't set policy for the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, as you all know. I do what I'm directed to say. We have very actively and very enthusiastically supported Hunters Against Hunger and all sorts of other food shelf concerns around the state. But as I said, our corporate board was quite adamant that if you're going to donate, you should donate. It's just like, as I said in the other committee, that if you're going to church and you're going to put money in the church basket, you should do so and be happy and be comfortable with the fact that you've donated and helped out your fellow man, so to speak. This is a larger problem that we do think should not be just put on the backs of deer hunters and a surcharge.
Okay, question. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify for or against House File, let's see, got to make sure, 2619? Okay. The Representative Davis, I'll make some comments that, because I like the idea that we'd be able to provide this meat source for the food shelves. I think that's a terrific part of the idea. Difficulty I have is that and it's from the testimony of Mr. Watts, that of the desired benefit. And the benefit of this is not only to provide for food shelves, but also for deer population management. And it's the excess deer that they're trying to manage. excess deer has never been a problem of the hunters. It's been a problem of the rest of us in society, especially those that drive cars and things, or if you don't want them in your neighborhood eating all your vegetables and that sort of thing. That's where kind of the frustration comes in with numbers. When I see us putting on a fee onto a population that does not benefit, and the hunters aren't benefiting from this dollar, that becomes a tax. And so this fee really does become, in my opinion, a tax. And so what I'd like to do is pursue with some others that have interest in trying to control the population. And if DNR could come up and maybe give us a little testimony as to what type of relationship do you have with the automobile insurance industry in helping DNR to control the population of the deer. What kind of contributions do they provide directly other than their regular taxation that we have here in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, we've certainly had some communication with the insurance folks, but there's no direct monetary connection in terms of attempting to manage the deer population.
It seems to me that there would be a direct relationship to the benefit of controlling the deer population to those of us that drive automobiles. And that I would think that the when you start looking at that base, it would be a very small piece. To me, it was not the amount, Mr. Vaught said that if we went to 50 cents, maybe that would be it. To me, it's not the dollar amount. It's really kind of the principle of the thing, for lack of a better explanation, of having deer hunters who aren't benefiting from that surcharge being required to pay it. And when I think that there is really another body or group out there that we should be in discussion with to help us with this overall effort, that really could benefit from a surcharge. And for them, it would be a surcharge. They get a direct benefit out of it. Representative Wiggins.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I, of course, think the insurance companies have stacks of money, and but what they're going to argue is the same thing that the deer hunters are arguing. They're going to say, we didn't cause the problem. We don't produce more deer. And so we're going to run into the same problem there.
Representative Luskinius, I differ in that the deer hunters do not benefit from this program, but the automobile or insurance industry would benefit from the program.
Okay, we have a different perspective here, because I think that I listened to the testimony and heard about the overpopulation means that there are too many deers who can rub noses, and that's not good. Deer hunters would benefit if we could cull the crop fairly quickly. We wait for the insurance company, it's going to be another year. But disease spreading is real, and we know about the tuberculosis, we know about the bovine, or whatever it's called. We could cull quickly this fall if we put the 50-cent surcharge on. I'd be happy with a dollar, but if 50 cents was a compromise, that'd be fine too. But deer hunters do benefit by knowing they have a healthy crop. And we have health problems in the deer herd. It's real. So I can't say that they don't benefit. Insurance companies would benefit too. That's another year of deer rubbing noses that probably shouldn't be.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Longinus, I thank you for that. I think you're right on with that. Also, I think, as Mr. Botts pointed out, there are deer hunters that do benefit. The person that would go to the food shelf and qualify for the food shelf would benefit quite a bit by putting a dollar in or 50 cents in and being able to go to the food shelf and take some venison home.
Other comments or questions? Mr. Gill.
Thank you. Well, I've really been giving some thought about this over the last couple of years on this insurance thing, and I was in somewhat jest originally, but I was thinking, you know, considering last year's action here at the legislature, we just simply need a crash impact fee.
Health care impact fee.
Yeah, a crash impact fee, and put it on the insurance policies and give it to the food shelves. Just another idea, Mr. Chairman. I'm full of ideas.
Mr. Chair?
Just about as close to connection, right?
If we wanted to do that, we... Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Hoppe?
If we wanted to do that, I mean, how many people have car insurance? We could get by with a couple of pennies per insurance policy. Who's going to know? Who knows what they pay for auto insurance?
We shouldn't have an extra
fee. That's
important. Just to give you an idea how complex the situation is that when we tried to make deer zones up north where you would open up areas to taking up more deer by agricultural areas, the rest of the hunters just got very jealous and hated that idea. And when the deer are really get hit in the roads, the collision industry, the auto bodies are just happier. I mean, they make a lot of money. And when you try to, when you're talking about cutting down the herd, you have to remember that there's been some years up north of 210, where you really got a great deer herd. When you cut down on the herd and people hear about it, it made a drastic difference in the number of tourists and hunters that came up, and therefore the economic growth slowed up there because when they hear there's no deer up there or the deer herd is really down, they just don't come up. So it's economics and management just conflicting all the time, and farmer, landowner, it's no easy way to solve it. It's been going on for years. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Well, Representative Davis, I want to also mention that as we've looked at how to encourage certain actions in the past, like we want to take more deer, we've looked at how to reduce the cost to the people that we're trying to get them to be active, not increase the cost on their activity. And it seems to me that this goes against that logic, that we want the deer hunters to take more deer, so we're going to charge them more to take the deer. It just goes in the opposite direction of logic that we've used around here for years. Maybe you have some light on that.
Well, going against logic around in this place happens from time to time.
I understand. But if I could,
I know we're very limited on time. The witness for the second bill is up here, and she's also a deer hunter, Jane Brown, and is the executive director of the Second Harvest Food Shelf, and she'd like to just make a couple comments on this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jane Brown, executive director of Second Harvest Heartland, and I am a deer hunter, and so I do want to be on record as saying that as a deer hunter, my husband's a deer hunter, that we do support this bill. A comment was made that deer hunters don't support it. I'm frankly surprised that the Deer Hunters Association, of which we've been a member off and on over the years, doesn't support it. I'm thrilled that you all do. Also, I want to talk about the expense. I apologize, I don't remember the woman's name. Betty Wilkins. I totally don't have any idea how much we pay for our license each year. And a 50 cents or a dollar is not going to make a difference as to whether or not we go after deer. The other thing I want to make clear is that venison is one of the healthiest red meats you can eat. Anyone who is on a diet for cancer knows that venison is a healthy food. The antioxidants in it are recommended. And that's one of the things I feel badly about is that our food shelves and our food bank does not have enough very healthy food, and especially for those for whom it's a medical necessity. So I do want to be on record of supporting this bill. Oh, one other thing. We do get calls every year, both before and after deer hunting opening, asking if we will take the deer, and we do have to turn it down unless it can be processed by a USDA or Minnesota Department of Agriculture processor.
And Ms. Brown, I think that around the table, I think we've all supported the concept of giving the deer to the food shelf, just like we support the milk going to the food shelf. It's who pays for it is what we're talking about. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. The House File 2619 is laid open for possible inclusion in the supplemental bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Okay. Next, we have House File 3666, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This committee last year picked up and filled in a hole. For some years, through a legal settlement, there was milk being donated to the Second Harvest Food Shelf, to the food bank. That settlement passed its time, and the legislature stepped up last year and made an appropriation, I believe it was $150,000, to Second Harvest Food Shelf for milk for the food shelves.
What this bill does, House File 3666, puts a $200,000 appropriation from the general fund. Basically, we go into the base, and I've got Jane Brown, her executive director of Second Harvest Food Shelf, here to testify on this bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jane Brown, executive director of Second Harvest Heartland, and I'm here representing the six food banks that cover the entire state of Minnesota. As was just explained, we had been the beneficiary of 5 years of milk, 250,000 gallons a year, through a legal settlement. That ended in December of 2004. Last year, we asked for an appropriation, biannual appropriation, to continue providing milk to the food shelves in Minnesota, and due to the fact that there wasn't enough money, we were very pleased to have received the $150,000. That $150,000 through a bidding process allowed us this year to have purchased and distributed 70,000 gallons of milk through the food bank and food shelf network. That was enough to last between, depending upon the area of the state, 3 to 4 months. We are back this year asking for another appropriation, knowing that it's not going to fully replace the previous amount, but asking for some money, the $200,000 that will keep us going for a while longer until we can come back during the budget cycle. I know with this committee I don't have to talk to you about the benefits of milk for our most vulnerable citizens, our children, our youth, and our senior citizens. It's an extremely important agriculture commodity, and we hope to be able to continue to provide it to our food shelves. Just a clarification, the food banks that do the bidding to get the milk don't distribute the milk directly. We distribute the milk to the food shelves, who then feed the needy. Last year, the food bank network provided over 40 million pounds of food to our member agencies, which are food shelves and on-site feeding programs and shelters, and we would like to continue to provide milk through this funding.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Brown. Any questions? Representative Davids, any additional testimony you'd like to give to the committee on this bill?
No, basically, I'd like to thank the committee for their time and consider this in their, if there's a finance bill.
Okay, any other questions by the members? There being none, we are, since there are no targets, we're going to lay this bill over as well for a possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
All right, and members, tomorrow, normal time. We have additional bills coming before us tomorrow, and also because of the deadlines and the way things are coming and the bills that are being re-referred to us, we don't know exactly what bills we'll be hearing in their entirety, so be ready to field the fly ball if necessary. With that, meeting adjourned.